Sí.
It is still barely good morning, Your Honors. Chief Justice Gregory.
Barely.
Barely. Judge Duncan, Judge Floyd. My name is Christopher Brown, and I have the privilege of representing the estate of Wayne Jones in this appeal from a district court's order denying the request to withdraw admissions deemed admitted inadvertently. That decision came following a remand from this court.
Deeming was inadvertent, or what was
it? It was an inadvertent failure to respond resulted in them being deemed admitted. That was my way of saying it. This court previously remanded the case so that the district court will review the 36B factors, given that the admissions themselves resulted in what amounted to a dispositive motion. And so I'm here today to persuade this panel that the district court abused its discretion. And in discovery orders, there is discretion, but it is an abuse of discretion to make a decision that is, one, either arbitrary or irrational, two, that fails to consider the judicially recognized factors that constrain the exercise of discretion that was satisfied in this instance, and the third, that relies on erroneous factual or legal premises. And I submit that points one and three are applicable here. The Rule 36B factors are clear. They're not disputed. The first is that whether or not allowing withdrawal would promote the presentation of the merits of the case. And the second factor is the prejudice to the other party, the appellees, or defendants in this case, of having to perhaps prove those facts or having to go to trial. Starting with the second point, because I believe respectfully it's easier to resolve, the prejudice to the parties. There were a litany of cases that were cited by both parties. And if we look at Conlin and Mumford and McClanahan v. Aetna and Fisherman's Wharf and Somerville v. Dobson, and last but not least, the MedPath case, and ranking them in amount of prejudice, I'd say MedPath must be at the bottom of that rung, right? And where this court found, well, there isn't a whole lot of prejudice here because the responses came 30 days late, but the court didn't feel comfortable that it was enough to find district court abuse discretion. And recognizing that as being sort of, you know, the bottom rung of prejudice, where even this court hesitated but found finding an abuse of discretion, here we're talking about 2 days late. If we have a discussion about what the cutoff is for determining when prejudice ensues to the non-moving party, being the party not moving to withdraw its admissions, all the other factors in these cases aren't even applicable here. The dispositive motions deadline hadn't run, discovery hadn't passed, discovery hadn't been engaged in with the reliance upon these admissions on these facts. This is about as quick a turnaround as this court will ever see.
Did you ever file a Rules of 36B motion to withdraw or amend?
No, Your Honor. No, and
part of the problem here is that the district court was in a bind of your creation. I mean, it could have grappled with that in a more timely manner.
It could have. But I'm comfortable that this court's remand order resolved that in accepting that the submitting responses to admissions, in effect, a motion to withdraw those inadvertently admitted. The opposition to the motion to deem them admitted, twice filed, would be considered a motion to withdraw. And so
I understand, but it didn't give the district court an opportunity to consider the issue before the clock kept running.
Right. So what Your Honor is getting at is the fact that the court viewed in its reviewing the prejudice as this being a request made 3 years later. In fact, it wasn't quite three, but whatever the date was. And I responded, of course, that this was actually 2 days later. The court just failed to recognize it at the time.
Well, it wasn't. Now, please.
Well, I wasn't counsel, trial counsel. That's something that should have been done. We can talk about that.
But not necessarily by the district court if no motion's filed. It's not the district court's failing.
Well, if the case law is fairly clear that...
So the district court should have affirmatively considered a motion to withdraw in the absence of one having been made?
Well, I think the district court should have recognized that filing responses to requests for admissions or opposing a motion to deem them admitted is viewed as a motion to withdraw.
Did anyone bring that to the court's attention?
Not at that time.
Well, that was my only point. I wasn't trying to argue with you substantively.
Your point is well made. I think it was the subject of the lengthy dissent as well in the remand order. But we are where we are, and we were happy to have gotten there. And once we're there, for the prejudice to be put on, to the prejudice to be the 3-year passage of time, when in fact there was a request to, as the case law interprets it, withdraw them 2 days later, then I had difficulty with her finding that it was a 3-year delay and thus the prejudice.
But in this of the matter being brought to the court to be addressed, it happened in part because you didn't file the. Motion wasn't filed. That's my only point. There is a passage of time. I'm not quite sure. You could say that perhaps the court didn't give sufficient weight to grappling with the reasons for the motion not having been filed. But the point is, there had been the delay, which wouldn't have occurred had the motion to withdraw been timely filed.
I think it helps me, of course, to look at it as the remand order advising the district court that it had failed to do something it should have done at the time, which is recognizing that this essentially made this a dispositive motion. It had the obligation to review the 36B factors.
Did it or did it? But that's what the district court did. So
after the remand.
Yeah.
But the remand order was pointing out that it wasn't done at the time, which is when it should have been done.
It should have been done. It would have been done. I mean, we're going around in circles, but I'm not going to let you put the responsibility for whoever's failure it was to file a motion to withdraw solely at the feet of the district court. That's my only point.
Well,
and I think you don't disagree with that.
Well, I don't disagree that it should have been done, but I do feel that the district court should have recognized on its own, independently, what I'm doing here is going to result in this case being dismissed. That is a dispositive motion based on the fact that these admissions have been deemed admitted. And if that's the case, I need to review these 36B factors myself. I cannot leave this to the magistrate judge.
Exactly when was the motion to withdraw made?
Well, under the case law, Judge Floyd, the responses were made 2 days late, which can effectively be viewed as a motion to withdraw the inadvertently deemed admissions given the late responses.
But you should have filed a motion as soon as you realized the mistake was made.
Certainly should have been.
All right, don't take comfort in this comment. I was a district judge. Had a motion been made promptly, I'd let you withdraw. However, 36B is a permissive rule, and We got to look at what the judge on remand, what the judge thought about Martinsville's case vis-a-vis the admissions and kind of thing.
It's a little bit of like, you know, who has the right of way. So when the defendants acted so proactively, they filed their first motion to deem them admitted the day the responses were due, and it was denied as being premature. And that was opposed by the estate. And then it was refiled a day or two later, and that was opposed. So you sort of get the situation where we've got this two-way street happening. Should the estate have also filed a point for withdrawal based on Rule 36B? Yes. But in opposing, which is why the case law says what it says, in opposing, the district court should recognize that they are, in fact, requesting to withdraw the admissions that are deemed admitted. And I don't think that's too much for just a court judge. I mean, they get it. They understand in opposing the motion to deem them admitted, they are, in fact, moving to withdraw the inadvertently admissions deemed admitted. And the reason the case law is as it is because they believe that this court feels that district court judges should recognize that. And having been remanded, it brings up an interesting issue. Is this a 3-year late request now being presented to the district judge for the first time? Or is it a request, was it a remand saying to the district court, you should have recognized this. This was a dispositive result given the admissions were deemed admitted.
I think it should be recognized as giving you another breath of life. I don't think it's quite as... I don't think it sanctions necessarily what was done. And my only point in raising it is that I think it is a context within which the district court acted and informs our analysis, and it would probably be helpful, at least from my perspective, for you to focus on that.
On
the- we think that the district court abused its discretion, but one of the factors that is relied on is the prejudice and the passage of time.
It is, and here I thought that was my easier factor. But I do feel that the remand order essentially says to the district court that the district court erred. It doesn't just say we've decided that, you know, the fault of nobody, this probably should go back.
I wouldn't proceed necessarily on the basis of that assumption.
Well, let me say it this way. It was remanded to say, well, we have a dismissal based on request for admissions deemed admitted, which resulted in that being a dispositive motion. And when that occurs, the 36B factors must be reviewed, sending it back because the district court did not do that.
You might want to go beyond that. Can you just move on with your argument?
Very well, Your Honor.
At least for my purposes.
Certainly. I think a district court sitting with request for admissions and a magistrate judge's ruling on them, and they come to you.
But you also didn't object to.
That is correct. I'd like to think that that was resolved by this court's prior remand order. We've gotten over that hurdle, thankfully.
Yeah, it is. It is resolved by.
Thank you.
Because we didn't. District court can't tell us it's too late to give a remedy in a case where we found there was an issue. It's not about putting blame on anybody. It's a matter of what the. In other words, there'll be a totality. Say, well, you remanded it, but I think it's just too late to do this now. I'm going to put all the time. No, that's why we go back to the analysis of what it would have been at the time. And you look at those things, but to say, oh, it's been 3 years, we knew that.
Correct.
We knew that.
That would have been at the top rung of my cases for prejudice.
Exactly.
If that were the case, there'd be no need to waste everybody's time, I respectfully would think. And that's how I viewed it. That's how I viewed it when I briefed it for the district court.
No discretion. I mean, that took away the discretion of the district court to even consider that factor?
Well, no, it's not going to take discretion away, but it can't be based on an erroneous legal or factual premise. And asserting that it was a three-year late request is an erroneous factual premise.
Well, there was a three-year late request. I mean, we sent it back for the district court to look at the maybe we're getting back into that.
Well, let me just say this before my 10 seconds run. I've saved 7 minutes. Except this court did find that the responses and the oppositions to the motions to deem admitted were requests to withdraw.
Right.
So if they were requests to withdraw, the request to withdraw was made then. And it might be a tough situation. It might be an uphill battle. It might be something we certainly want to avoid in the future. Because the passage of time can hurt things, although there hasn't been that allegation. That's the situation. The request was made 2 days later. I don't think we can really get past that. We can sort of say, well, technically, Mr. Brown, we view the request was made 2 years late. However, in reviewing prejudice, we're going to view this differently. Maybe the court will come to an opinion that says that. But at this time, I feel comfortable with the fact that the request was made 2 days late.
Well, for my purposes, could you just quickly tell me why the district court abused its discretion?
On the second prong, for relying on an erroneous factual premise that the request came three years late, there is no other basis for holding that factor in favor of the defendants. On the first prong, it's relying on an erroneous factual premise. That is, if you're looking at Scott v. Harris in the U.S. Supreme Court and the Witt v. Bowman case out of the Western District of Virginia, video evidence, I don't have to go as far as to say it supports my client's position, the estate's position. I have to say it does not result in a rejection of the estate's position. But more than that, it does support the estate's position. And it was an erroneous factual premise for the district court to say that the record supported the self-serving statements of the officers. And I'll see you on my reserve time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. Mr. Severin.
Good afternoon. It's now afternoon.
It is indeed.
thank you, Chief Judge Gregory, Judges Duncan and Floyd. My name is Philip Saver, and I represent the appellees in this case. As to the discussion that was just had by counsel, I wanted to point out that I think it's relevant to the calculation of whether or not the district court exercised her discretion appropriately, that although there was a motion filed to have the request deemed admitted, and although the appellant in this case did respond to that, they did not respond with any of the Rule 36B factors that I think this case involves. The responses at that point had to do with the calculation of the days. And then, of course, there was the issue about not appealing the magistrate court's ruling. And I understand that this court on remand determined that the district court, because of the unique circumstances, should consider whether or not those factors applied. And in fact, that's what happened. Once it went back to the district court, what she did is she entered an order asking both sides to present briefs on a certain date. And then she provided another date, and she said, I want both sides to then file the responses to the other side's briefs. In our brief, the appellee's brief, we cited to the videotape. We cite videotapes, plural. We cited to the deposition testimony. We also put in additional evidence that was not in the court record but had been exchanged during discovery, and that was a picture of the knife. I know there was some concern the previous appeal about whether or not there was anything to corroborate the admission that Mr. Jones had a knife and wouldn't put it down. So we put in evidence of a photo of the knife of the state police, West Virginia State Police investigation that showed the wounds to Officer Staub as well as the treatment. The appellant's presentation was these admissions are dispositive and therefore they should not be, that they should be allowed to be withdrawn because they're dispositive. And the case law they cited for that, particularly is a case called Conlon, says that that's true, that that meets the first factor when that's the only evidence of that issue. In other words, if the only thing there is in the record to show that there was a knife was an admission, well, maybe then it meets the 36B factors. But if there's other evidence in the record, then there's a question about whether or not the withdrawal of the admissions would meet the first factor, which is the presentation of the case on the merits. And so that was one reason why we presented that evidence into the record. And I also wanted to call the court's attention to the remand order that says very clearly in the last sentence, this order in no way opines on the merits of such consideration. So I think the burden was on the appellant, as it is in these Rule 30B6 motions, to present evidence to show that withdrawing the admissions is within the court's discretion and promotes the presentation of the merits. No argument was presented. No evidence was presented.
Well, the record speaks for itself. You've seen the tape many times because I've seen it over and over and over and over. And the one to me most telling is, I think, is Officer Herb. Was he the last officer to get there?
I'm not 100% sure on that, Judge.
You're not sure? The one where there were four officers on top of him, with him. And then you see the fifth officer get out of his.
Oh, yes. I just didn't know the name.
That's
right. Yes.
Yeah, I know you've seen it. If I've seen it twice.
No, I just didn't associate the name.
Yeah. Okay, I'm sorry. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. It shows him on the ground. First, you can hear the audio. He's being choked. You can hear him. He's gurgling for breath. And you notice before they shoot him, his body never changes. You can see he doesn't raise up. He doesn't raise up at all. You can see it. He's there on the ground. And then they move away from him. And then five of them shoot him, what, 20 sometimes? Now, I mean, it seems to me, you're looking at that. If one person is choking him, what are the other three doing? Why? I mean, they were there. You can see them. What are they doing? I mean, it's not like they were saying, okay, I think you can take him. We're going to stand back and watch and see what happens. They were on him. And then they back away. And that was the first shot. They shot him in the head, didn't they? Then they shot him in the face.
I don't think there's evidence about which shot, the sequence of the shot.
Or not the sequence. I'm talking about he was shot in the head, right?
In the face, different parts of his body.
But you can see, even in the video, he never raises up at all. As a matter of fact, he was on his down and right, right? He's on the right with his left shoulder up and the right down. Did you see the video?
Yeah, yes, Judge, I am. I'm just waiting to respond.
No, but my question is, you're saying that it's clear evidence, and then turns it corroborates what he was doing. And see, the point is that, let's say he had a knife. The question is, at the point they shot him, was that knife a present threat to them? Where it was and where that position he had been in, right? Well, what position was he in when he was being choked? Was he on his stomach?
You want me to answer?
Yes. Okay. I'm doing this because you started off, rather than looking at the 36B factors, you came in saying, oh, it's clear here, it's by the record. So I'm going where you took the case. What was he on his stomach when they were choking him? The video is there. You've seen it. How was his body? You can see his legs. You can see his body, the whole, before they shot him. And you can see he doesn't raise up at all. Matter of fact, he's in the same position before the shots, during the shots, and after the shots. So I'm asking you, where is that clear? Where is that? Tell me.
And I will respond to that. And my response to that is, I don't think that is clear from the videos. And I would. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead, finish that.
I was also going to
What's not clear from the video?
What
happened? Right.
What exactly? There's not. It's not a great quality to the videos.
You can see clearly his body.
You can see his body. What I'm saying is, you can't see exactly what position he's in terms of how he's moving, where the officers are, what he's doing. The fact remains that there was an officer who was cut on his hand and was cut on his side.
I'm glad you mentioned that. They did an examination on the knife, and there was no blood, was it? Is that right?
There was no DNA found on the knife. That's correct. And Mr. Jones was wearing a glove. But what I wanted to say, Your Honor,
there was a picture of the wound, such as it was.
Yes.
How did you start out this line of response is what I'm not remembering. Did you say that the district court, the estate did not bring forward?
Correct.
Okay, that was what I thought you were saying.
Yes.
Not that there was none, but response to the district court's order.
Correct. Okay. And then I think Judge Gregory said that the record. Right,
yeah.
Correct. So I think that's how,
make
right.
Sure I understood
but
it.
I think this is important, Judge Gregory, and whether or not I'm persuasive on it is, I guess we'll find out. However, I would point to the appellant's own brief before this case, for this court. And this is in the corrected opening brief. It's on page 29 of the brief, page 35 and 51. It says, talking about the video and the poor quality of the video, said the confrontation on the landing is not shown on the video. The court cannot determine whether Jones' hands raised was an act of aggression or whether he had a knife in his hand at that point. And we agree with that. Further, the video depicts the sounds made by the officers, but it does not depict what Jones was actually doing. That's why I think that the video itself is not sufficient to show that the officers, under the standard that we're working under, which is the soldier of your cats, whether or not there was a reasonable mistake as to the facts or whether or not how they perceive things. I mean, we know all the standards. I don't need to go through the 2029 standard view of the officer. I know we get all that. But I think as far as relying on the video for that, I think there's an agreement on both sides that the video does not fairly depict
what Jones was doing, and so I have to rely on testimony. And the admissions that this court deemed were dispositive, which this court has said, this court has recognized, and the appellants have recognized, are that Mr. Jones refused commands to stop resisting after being tased. In other words, they had used lesser means of force. That Mr. Jones had a knife, that Mr. Jones refused to drop the knife after being commanded to do so, and that Mr. Jones had stabbed an officer before the shots were fired. Now, that's the material admissions that we're talking about here, and that's the ones that this court directed the district court to go back and examine, and given the opportunity to present that to the district court, the appellants did not present evidence. They said only that this is dispositive. And then in their response brief, they said something along the lines of, they went through the this court's remand, they mentioned Judge Voorhees' dissent, and they said that the decision is self-evident, was the words that they used. In other words, they were relying on the fact that there was this remand to say that that alone was sufficient, because they say, look, we didn't do all these things, we had these defaults that Judge Voorhees had pointed out, and yet we were remanded. And I think that they didn't rise to the occasion with respect is what my point is.
Well, let's assume that the motion in opposition to the admissions is a Rule 36 motion. Should we look at the record at that time or as it's been supplemented for a withdrawal motion?
Well, I think we should look at it on remand, because basically what this court said is a whole new ballgame. I'm sorry.
At the time the opposition was filed, or at the time the case was sent back?
Well, if we look at it, I think when the case was sent back, I would say, because if we look at the time that it was submitted, there was no presentation then at all in the Rule 36B factors. At least this time they mentioned it. Plus, I think what this court was saying in the remand is, look, these admissions are important enough that we want the district court to focus on this issue and not penalize the estate, because there was no appeal from the magistrate's ruling, which then would have allowed this court to look at the abuse of discretion at that point. So now what we're in the position of is evidence presented in the appeal brief. And the judge, district judge, had an opportunity to look at those because it was not presented before. And ordinarily what I've done in these situations is I make a list of what are the evidence, what are the citations, and what's our response. And I thought that we might need to have a hearing with the district judge. I thought there might be evidence presented that we need to discuss, but that never happened. And I understand perhaps Judge Gregg, your point that, well, that wasn't necessary because we had the video, but we had the video the first time. And the question for the judge is, well, look at this other evidence. What evidence do you have that shows that if we withdraw the admissions that I just mentioned, then we don't have this evidence in the record? And that's what we attempted to do. And now I can go through the evidence that they presented, and I'm happy to do that.
Counsel,
yes, Your Honor.
The remand was then to go back and look at whether or not, applying the 36B factors, whether they should have allowed the withdrawal of the inadvertently admitted admissions.
Correct.
And it has to be. And think about this case. Judge Floyd makes a good point in terms of what's before you at the time. But at the time, because the city, the officers, council, immediately said, in fact, the next day, deemed them admitted, issue was really joined on that question, really. You know, the whole issue had to be when you oppose it. No, I don't want them deemed admitted. Because it's inadvertent. And in this case, we know so, because even the reason given was an inaccurate count of time. Wrong, but inadvertent. You know, I mean, I practiced law for a long time, but, you know, I can't imagine in a case like this where, you know, you got a case where a person, and I'm not saying anything wrong because it hasn't had a chance to go to any merits, but a person who is walking down the street, and he says he's walking in the middle of the street, because the video that I saw, he's walking in the street but near the curb, and you can see a parked car. He goes around the parked car, and he goes right back in. And the time he stopped, he's actually in the crosswalk. And then the man just says, I just want to go the distance. It goes a few minutes later, he's shot 20 times or so by officers. And so the question is, and during the holidays, 1 or 2 days late, you deem that admitted? I mean, I just can't imagine. I mean, in other words, I mean, when I practice law, I mean, I know you have to be represent your client, but I would deem that from an ethical standpoint, from a professional standpoint, I wouldn't even try to push that to the court that that's deemed admitted in that. But that's another thing. But that's
I understand.
And I have to take issue with that. There's simply
take issue with my question.
No, I have to take issue with. I mean, there's nothing wrong with the. There's nothing wrong there. They can do it. Now, whether they.
Yes, I know they can do it. My question is the context of when someone, when you deem something admitted. And my point is, it's inadvertent. It's undisputed. It was during the holidays. It was the issue was joined on the question right away. That those are the factors you kind of you're looking at in that sense, and you may be right. I mean, who wins the case? That's not before us. We haven't gotten to the merits of the case, but I'm talking about now to say it's clear by the other evidence that wouldn't have made any difference. My point is this, and then I'm gonna finish with this: the fact that he had a knife. That's why he had a knife. That's not dispositive of the question of excessive force. Alone, because you could have a knife. The point, though, is was he properly subdued by five officers on top of him? He's down on the ground. They were choking him. And if you found a knife there under him or wherever it was, we don't know. You're right. You can't.
It was in his hand. Right. It was found in his hand.
What do you say?
It was seen by the officers in his hand.
That's what they say.
And it was found in the hand.
Right.
Yes. Right. I'm just saying that that's the evidence. But
one of the officers said, where is the knife? And wasn't he one of the officers?
One of the officers did not see the knife. Four of them did.
That's an officer who shot him. Didn't see a knife? Who was shooting him?
I'm sorry, Ron. I did not drill. I understand. And I'm just saying.
Are you saying one of the officers who was shooting him never saw the knife?
I'm saying that there was an officer who saw that felt a poke, saw the knife, said he's got a knife. One of the officers said, I heard him say he had a knife. I did not see personally the knife. I heard the other. That's what I'm saying.
And my only question is, was that officer the one who was shooting him?
And I'm sorry, preparing for this argument, I did not drill down that far.
You don't know the answer.
I can supplement it.
No, you don't need to supplement.
I don't have that detail in my head right now is what I'm saying. That specific detail I don't have in my head.
And we sent this back and then – the main and only reason is basically that the court says this 3 years of passage of time.
That's not the only thing that the court said.
I don't think that's
the main thing that the court says. I think the court spent a fair amount of time going through, cited the evidence on the merits, talked about the video, talked about the deposition testimony. Then she went on and said, on the prejudice prong, I find this. That was not the main thing. She went through it very sequentially.
The problem is
that was not the main point, Judge. Yes.
The problem in cases like this is, again, some sense of understanding. When you have an excessive force case where the person is shot to death, well, first of all, he's not going to be able to testify. You're going to always have the persons who are living to say what happened. Therefore, you have to rely on, otherwise the case would be closed. Well, he's dead. This is what happened. You know, you have to look at the totality of the situation. Yes. And one of the big parts of it is this. Not just whether the knife, you say it's in his hand, right? In his hand, correct? You said it was in his hand?
That was the testimony. He had a glove and it was in his hand.
Okay. Can you see from that he was in his right hand or his left hand?
Your Honor, I was not there. I don't know, and I don't know.
You know, every time I ask you a question about the record when it's favorable, you have clarity.
No, I'm
saying. When I ask you something that you didn't use, I don't know about that.
No.
I ask you, do you even know?
I don't know which hand.
You don't even know what. Don't you think that's important based on the fact?
I don't think it's important.
Won't you let me ask the question? It is important.
Which hand it's in. I don't. I can check the record and tell you what the officer said. I don't know.
How in the world could it not be important as to what hand it's in? Because you can clearly see that he is down on his right side. So if he had a knife down on his right side and the man weighed about 162 pounds, right? I just tell you, you don't know. But five grown men were on top of them, on top of him. And someone said, knife. I'm not saying about the merits of, we don't know what happened. That's why you have courts and that's why we have juries to determine that. But you say it's not relevant what hand is in? If you can clearly see on the video, he's down and he was being choked, grappling for air before they shot him. You can hear him. He's, am I correct about you? Remember that? Do you remember that?
Judge, I have not.
Do you remember the audio? You could hear him gurgling for breath.
I do not recall gurgling sounds.
No, okay. No,
I can.
Asking us that from the record. Never mind. I have nothing for him. Nothing for him.
I'm past my time. Can I have 2 minutes to say some more, or are we done?
Go ahead.
Okay. I just wanted to say the evidence that was presented in this court, in the brief, I have, like I said, I've got a long list, but I'm not going to go through them all. But I wanted to say that there are facts that are cited. I mean, that there are facts that are listed with no citations that are plainly false, such as that Staub's knife was found on Mr. Jones' body. There are facts that are not supported by the citations in the record, such as that the officers did not see a knife, that the estate was not allowed to inspect a knife, that Mr. Jones was face down and unconscious when he was shot. There are inferences that they've made that are not supported by the record, such as saying the knife was planted on Mr. Jones. Their support for that is that their expert could not rule out that the knife was not planted. That was never presented to the district judge. If it was, we would have addressed it, all these things. That there was no knife, and yet they all produced, and that was because of the admissions, but then we have presented evidence of that.
Can I ask, would that have been resolved had the district court held the hearing that you were anticipating?
Yes, having? Yes. We would have been at that point to address those.
I was very surprised on remand that it was decided without a hearing.
I was expecting that we might go before Judge Groh and have, and I could go through each of these that I cannot do in 20 minutes, and also that I couldn't necessarily fit into the brief and make it comprehensible. Some that are just rank speculation, saying that the video didn't capture, like I said, what Mr. Jones was actually doing. With due respect to Judge Gregory, I understand that Judge Gregory does not agree, but that's what the plaintiff appellant said. And that the videos have been altered. That was litigated early on in the case, and they're just bringing it up now. None of this, again, was presented to the district judge, and so my concern is that this court is in the position of reviewing de novo under an abuse of discretion standard, that which would not have been presented to the district court. And I apologize for not having all the answers, Judge Gregory, but I tried my best to prepare for the issues that I thought were going to be important to this hearing.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Brown?
Very briefly, with my 7 minutes, I have a few points I would like to make. The first being that the language in this court's remand order, the facts admitted constructively resolved all of the material issues in dispute, giving the motion a dispositive effect. I found that language very reminiscent of the Conlin v. U.S. case, which I cited, which says, courts have found that this prong is met, the first prong, the 36B factors, when, as here, the deemed admissions effectively resolve the case, and thus upholding the admissions would eliminate any need for a presentation on the merits. That is what happened here. The dispute over the facts doesn't have to be that complicated. We could spend 4 hours talking about the facts. The simplest low-lying fruit is the video does not require a rejection of the estate's version of events. And in fact, it goes further and does not support the officer's version. Mr. Savin, I have a great relationship. I'm trying to learn everything I can from him. But I will say this. There was evidence in the record that supported our conclusory assertion that the knife was not, in fact, on Mr. Jones. And that is, it was alleged, as stated, that it was poking through his glove. But there was no note in the autopsy, which was very meticulous about all of his clothing, that there was anything wrong with the glove that was recovered. So there was, if it wasn't poking through the glove, when the officer said it was poking through the glove, and we know one of the officers lost a knife at the scene during the fight, during the struggle, and there's a wound to one of the officers, which is so minor that there's no DNA evidence on the knife.
Well, that doesn't necessarily, I mean,
it doesn't.
It's making me nervous because all of this is, there are facts that are challenged. There are facts that are unsupported. That was why I was hoping the district court would have a hearing because there was also evidence, as Mr. Severin pointed out, that Mr. Jones wore gloves. And there's more than one glove. So the fact that one glove wasn't damaged doesn't mean that the other glove didn't have a knife hole in it. There's just,
well,
the question that's actually presented is whether or not the district court abused its discretion.
Yes, which is why I'm trying to get my easiest route there, which is that video, the videos do not require a rejection of the estate's position, and they clearly, if you were to ask me candidly, they do not support the officer's position. That they were in fear for their lives because Mr. Jones, at some point in time, which is not seen on the video, brandished a weapon, stabbed an officer, and had to be subdued and shot and killed. Putting that next to the video, it becomes very difficult. I believe that the Supreme Court case Scott v. Harris and the Witt case are consistent with Reeves versus Anderson Plumbing, where the court said, the court must disregard defendant's evidence that the jury is not required to believe. And they're not required to believe it if there's something else that suggests an alternate set of facts. That video suggests a jury could find an alternate set. We're not here to say we win. We're here to say that the trier of fact needs to resolve that issue. The discussion we're having suggested a trier of fact.
Decide whether or not the district court abused its discretion.
Well, I'm moving into the first prong that she made an erroneous factual premise. And that was, and she had 2 points, Judge Gregory, on the prejudice prong, 3 years. Done. No other discussion. Nothing about deadlines, nothing about what the resulting prejudice was, witnesses being missing,
aren't
nothing like that.
Don't you have to meet all of them?
Yes. And the first prong was, it would promote the presentation of the merits. So we get into the factual. In other words,
did I say that right? Conjunct? Yeah.
Yeah, it's not an or. I have to satisfy both prongs. So what the district court does to satisfy the first prong is to say, there's no point in me doing this because the record entirely corroborates these admissions anyway. So I'm not going to waste everybody's time. That, respectfully, I don't think the court has to go far to say, we don't have to say irrational and arbitrary under the first point of abuse of discretion, but it was an erroneous factual premise to say that the record 100% corroborates the officer's events. Thereby, I would not be promoting the presentation of the case on the merits by allowing a withdrawal. And a case cited by the appellees that I closed with in our reply brief, the Adventist case, quoting McClanahan, the decision to allow a party to withdraw its admissions is quintessentially an equitable one. And I think that goes to what Justice Gregory is saying, and I'm sure Judge Floyd, having sat in the district court, 2 days late is, oof, when you're served on December 23rd with request for admissions, how many times you might call opposing counsel? Listen, you serve these on Christmas. You're going to give me an extra week at the holidays, New Year's, the bowl games are on, whatever it might be. Is there anything equitable about 2 days late where the estate's claims are just, they just disappear and they don't get their day in court? And if nobody disagrees that that's the case, and it is, and I'm not suggesting it's unethical, and I know Judge Duncan had an issue, But in practice, can we make even an argument that it would be equitable to allow this the estate's claims to be summarily dismissed under these circumstances? And I'm asking the court find that the district court abused its discretion on the second 36B factor. It came to an erroneous legal premise. On the first factor, it came to an erroneous factual premise. The record in no way corroborates the officer's version of events when you look at the videos. We can say it. That does not make it true. And if these are supposed to be, if this is the province of the jury to determine these things, this is how you have to say it. It has to be that it corroborates 100%. Otherwise, it's the jury's job. That's why it's written that way, respectfully. If we look at the video and we recognize that that is not entirely accurate, then it's the jury's job. It's not the district court's job. And we'd like to be remanded for the opportunity to go to trial. 5 seconds overdue.
All right. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
We'll ask the clerk to adjourn the court for the day. Then we'll come down to Greek counsel.
This honorable court stands adjourned until tomorrow morning. God save the United States and this honorable court.